All right, so hi everyone, my name is Cole. I'm going to be telling you about a new quantum algorithm that I came up with about a year ago, and I've been working on with my friend Craig, who's going to be joining the Zoom link soon, so I can introduce you. And it claims to solve NP-complete problems. Now I'll be explaining what these problems are and why they're important, but just solving the problem is not that incredible. I could come up with a classical algorithm that solves NP-complete problems. For example, check every solution. Not very efficient, but it is an algorithm that solves NP-complete problems. I would like this algorithm to do better, but in order to do that, I need to prove something about its complexity, which I'm going to be trying to do for my PSI essay. And we'll see how that goes. So this is a bit of a before talk, and hopefully I'll be giving you an after talk when I've maybe proved something about it. But I'll give you a quick rundown on some complexity theory. It won't really be necessary, but it's going to explain what we want for a certain type of algorithm. So big O notation is concerned with the worst case running time of an algorithm. So this means that for any function that describes how the algorithm scales with the size of the input n, we want to know what the fastest growing term in that function is. So if it depends on like 2n plus 2, we ignore everything, including like anything that's multiplied by the factor. We just call it O of n. It's linear. Same with some polynomial of n. It's just the fastest growing polynomial in that, just the big O of that. Same with exponential. This is an exponential algorithm where n appears in the argument of the exponential. So these are how different algorithms or different functions would scale, but we're interested in the worst case running time for the algorithm, so we can say something about it in total. Now, we're going to do some complexity classes. So what this is here is a Venn diagram of the different complexity classes, and this is how we think of them currently. So this little one here, this is P. These are all the algorithms that have polynomial running times. We call these efficient, with a little asterisk, because there can be polynomial time algorithms that are very difficult to run actually, like n to the 1,000 is a polynomial algorithm, but not very good. We want to do better. But for all intents and purposes, these are the efficient algorithms in the class P, and they are contained in the class NP. So NP stands for non-deterministic polynomial time something. But really, it's all of the problems that can be efficiently verified. So if I present you with a problem and you give me an answer, I can efficiently check whether or not that actually solves my problem. All of these types of problems are in the class NP. Now we also have this other set called NP-hard, and these are the problems that we expect to be exponential. They are incredibly difficult. This is like the halting problem or chess. Very, very difficult problems, and the least hard problems in that class are NP-complete. Now, NP-complete problems, I'll be going over, and these are the types of problems that this algorithm claims to solve. Does it solve it efficiently? Help me prove it. I don't know. But we'll be talking a lot about NP-complete problems. These are the very interesting ones for fun reasons. Now, this is the class of BQP. These are basically the quantum algorithms. So we know that quantum computers are Turing complete. They can do everything that a classical computer can do. Plus, they can do some things that classical computers can't do. There are certain types of computations that we could prove that cannot be done classically. Now the question is, how powerful are quantum computers? Can they solve maybe all of the problems in NP? Could they solve more than that? We don't actually know. But we know that they can do things differently than classical computers, and the relationships are not fully understood. Now, NP-complete problems are interesting because they're complete, meaning that every problem in the class NP has a polynomial time reduction to an NP-complete problem. So this means that if you give me a problem in NP, I can perform an operation on it that turns it into an NP-complete problem. And if I solve an NP-complete problem, that means that I solve every problem in the class NP, which would be great. Lots of very interesting problems are in the class NP, most of the ones we care about in computer science. Now, this is just what we think the relationship between these classes is. You might have heard of the famous P equals NP problem. This would prove that there's a polynomial algorithm for every problem in the class NP. Essentially, you just solve an NP-complete problem in polynomial time. And this would collapse the hierarchy into something like this. it would mean that every problem in the class NP has a polynomial time algorithm. But it could also look maybe like this. This would mean that NP is actually a subset of PQP, meaning that if it turns out that quantum computers can solve NP-complete problems, then quantum computers could solve all the problems in NP, but classical computers could not. There would still be problems outside of the range of classical computers. Are these all the classes? Absolutely not. This is just the classes from A to F. There's like 500 and something in total. So there's a lot of these classes, and you can prove interesting things about them. Most of what is proved is the relationship between classes. So I can prove that this problem is at least as hard as E, or like harder than EE, or like much harder than EE, or I don't know. So why do we care about NP-complete problems? Well, because they're complete. If you solve an NP-complete problem in polynomial time, you've solved every problem in the class NP. These are very interesting problems, very difficult problems that a lot of people care about. And it deals with the fundamental limits of what is computable using the machines that we have at our disposal. It really deals with like what is computable in nature. So we have like certain ideals of what a Turing machine is, and we can ask questions about what could possibly be computed on that. And we can ask the same of quantum computers. But the issue is, what can we fundamentally compute in reasonable time scales in our universe? This is the sorts of problems that complexity theorists deal with. Now, all of the problems that are verifiable in polynomial time are in NP. Even problems that don't seem like they're verifiable in a classical amount of time. This is like the traveling salesman problem. This is a classic NP-complete problem. If I have a large graph with a bunch of nodes that we can call cities, and I want to know what is the shortest path through this graph that touches all of the cities, I could ask this question, and it's a well-posed question, and you could give me a solution. But how would I verify that it's the shortest path? It seems very hard to do. How would I do that without enumerating all the possible paths? Well, I can rephrase it in a way that says, are there paths shorter than this path that you presented? And if the answer is no, then you've presented the shortest path. So I can turn problems that don't seem like NP-complete problems at first glance into NP-complete problems. This includes mathematical proofs that have bounded length. These are things that if you present me with a real proof, I can verify that it's a real mathematical proof. And if I can solve NP-complete problems in polynomial time, then anything that can be proven mathematically with a bounded number of steps, I just need to check all of the size steps that would take up to that number to prove it using my NP-complete algorithm. So these are very interesting problems, and lots of things can be phrased in terms of NP-complete problems. They're very interesting. Now, the first ever NP-complete problem that was proven to be NP-complete by Cook and Levin is satisfiability. This is just Boolean variables that can be true or false, 0, 1, red or blue, whatever you want. You're given a propositional logic formula that has operations like and or not, and parentheses. The problem is to find a satisfiable truth assignment of these variables that makes the logical statement true. So this is an example of a three-sat problem. So three-sat meaning just for every single one of these clauses, there's three variables. And the goal of satisfiability is to find an assignment that sets this whole statement true. So for example, if I set A to 1 and D to 1, this is true. It doesn't matter what B and C are. But there's probably other ones as well. But as you get more and more variables and more clauses, these problems get very, very hard. They're NP-complete, meaning that every problem in the class NP can be reduced to this problem exactly right here, satisfiability. Now, what's interesting about quantum computers? Well, they contain a lot of information. If I want to describe an arbitrarily entangled system of n qubits, I require 2 to the n coefficients to describe that state fully. And this is an exponential growth. It grows very fast. With 4 qubits, I can simulate this on my laptop, no problem. 16 coefficients, easy. Do that on a blackboard. Write matrices out, do the multiplication, no problem, no problem. 20 qubits, we have over 1 million coefficients already. And just with 300 qubits, I require more coefficients than there are particles in the observable universe. It grows very fast, very fast. So just with 300 electrons, I need more classical bits than there are particles in the observable universe. It grows so fast, okay? The main point here, the takeaway, is that Hilbert space is huge. It grows really fast. It grows real big, real big. Now, a bit of a crash course on quantum computing. These are some single qubit gates. These are not all of them, but these are the ones that I'll be using. This is the classic Pauli X gate. It just flips something from 0 to 1 or 1 to 0, or the amplitudes on that as well. Hadamard takes a pure state in 0 or pure state in 1 into an equal superposition of both of them. And then we're going to be making lots of use of this. Now, we can have multi-qubit gates. This is a very elucidating slide. You're just looking at matrices. But I think it's nice to look under the hood once in a while, see what a matrix is doing. So the controlled knot here, this acts, it knots the second qubit only if the first one is 1. So it selects the part of the wave function where this qubit is 1 and flips this from whatever it was before to the logical knot of what it is. This is what the matrix looks like. Same with this, but it's a controlled Hadamard gate. So it only applies the Hadamard gate if this qubit right here is 1. And this, I can build arbitrarily controlled gates. This has two controls. So this is like a classical AND gate almost. Like if the two inputs are 1, then I'll flip the output from 0 to 1. And it's really analogous to a classical AND gate, but this is the quantum version. My algorithm is going to be making use of three input AND gates, essentially. So we're going to be controlled based on the three inputs that are going to correspond to my clauses in my SAT problem.
Sorry, Paul?
Yeah.
Does it matter that the Hadamard gate is not invertible?
Is not?
Invertible.
Invertible.
Is your algorithm entirely like unitary steps?
So I can make it reversible just by adding more ancillary qubits. But right now, as the algorithm that I'm going to present to you, it's not reversible, but that's just convention. I could make it reversible if I wanted to. I'm performing destructive measurements or like projective measurements that will destroy it in some sense, but I could very well just add more qubits, make it completely reversible, and uncompute everything that I did back into the zero basis. Yes?
Sorry, your question is about
Hadamard
is reversible?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Hadamard is completely reversible.
But with auxiliary qubits?
Yes.
Yes.
Like I could perform this twice and it would go back to the exact same state.
Thank you.
Now, how do we build a quantum circuit that corresponds to a given SAT problem? Well, we're going to have one qubit for every single variable in the problem. So in this case, there's four variables, and we're going to have one qubit for each of them, these four here. And then we're also going to have one ancillary qubit. This is just a little helper guy that we're going to use to do our computations with, and you'll see why it's useful in the end. To make it reversible, we would just add more of these for however many operations we're doing, and we could make it reversible, no problem. So in this case, we're going to have five qubits, and we're going to put them in an equal superposition, the variables that correspond to, or the qubits that correspond to variables. So it's equally probable that I'll be in any of the combinations of these four, but the last one will be always in zero. So this is the last qubit here that's not in one yet. Now, instead of working with the three-sat instance, I'm actually going to be working with the logical knot of the three-sat instance. It's essentially the same thing, but what this does is it turns all of my clauses, which are a bunch of ors between variables, into a bunch of ands between variables. And I said that this is a three-input Toffoli. This is equivalent to like a classical AND gate with three inputs, basically. So I can encode this statement right here into a quantum gate. And I knot the relevant variables, in this case A. And this is exactly what this clause is saying. So I select the part of the wave function where this is true, and then I put it on here. So the part of the wave function for these four variables that makes this true will go here, and then I can perform operations based on that. Now the reason we're working with the knot of the SAT and not the actual SAT itself is because it would be very difficult to directly increase the probability of a satisfiable state to our problem. But what I can do, and what I'm going to show you, is reduce the probability of measuring states that don't solve the problem. And if I can do this and iterate it enough times, then I'll eventually have a very high probability of measuring a solution to my problem. That's exactly what we're going to do. Yes.
And are those two things that you just said supposed to be the same side or different sides of the same coin, like turning it into ands and the reducing the probability of those that don't satisfy?
Yes. So I don't know how I could encode a circuit that would directly increase and only select on the states that increase or that actually solve my problem. Because probability is normalized. If I make the probability increase in one state, I have to reduce the probability in other states. So what I can do is I can just perform operations that reduce the probability of measuring the states that correspond to not solving my problem. And just by not touching the ones that solve them, they will just gain more probability over time. So essentially, I'm only reducing the probability of the states that don't satisfy my problem. And because probability is normalized, it will increase the probability of measuring a satisfiable solution. Yes?
I got lost.
Yes.
Wait, we initialize all of the qubits in zero?
Yes. Yes.
So what is RC tree time?
So this is just this gate here, but with an extra control. So it would be controlled, and it would only flip this if this imaginary one up here, this one, and this one were all one. But if I wanted this one to be zero and not one, I could add a not before and after, and then it would only select the parts where this is zero, one, one, and then it would flip this last qubit based on that.
Like a gate of four?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Kind of generalize stuff for the gate.
Yes. Yes. And like I'm working with 3-sat, but really this algorithm should generalize to any number of variables in a clause. Mm-hmm. So I can build operations that select the part of the wave function corresponding to the logical knot of the sat problem. And I can do this for both clauses, for any number of clauses in my problem. Now we're going to see what we can do with them. So now, based on the output of this gate that we just invented, I'm going to perform a controlled Hadamard on the qubits that correspond to my variables in the clause that we're interested in. So here's where, after I explain this, I'm going to go to a hopefully a live demonstration, and we're going to see how it affects the probabilities, because that's how I learned, and I think it's illuminating. But essentially, I'm selecting the part of the wave function that makes this clause true, which means that it makes my sat problem false. And then I apply what used to be a definite state for these, because there's only one assignment that makes this true. And then I'm turning it into an indefinite state. It's selecting based on whether or not this is the part of the wave function that I'm acting on. So I take it from a definite state of like 0, 1, 1, and then I mix it back up and I say, you don't know what you are anymore. And I control Hadamard them. And I can do the same thing with the other clauses as well. This is just a destructive measurement that will reset this qubit back to the zero state so I can perform another operation on it. If I wanted to make it reversible, I wouldn't do this. I would just add another auxiliary qubit to do this one on, another one for all the other subsequent operations. But this is how you build a circuit corresponding to the sat problem. Yes?
So if you read this picture, it's from left to right.
Where left to right.
From the thing that actually solves the sat problem.
Yes.
And then you take it to the vacuum, and then you apply that. I don't understand what that is, but the RC3X.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. On the right side?
Yes, yes. So the time axis goes this way, and then I'm going to perform a measurement on the qubits that are in the that correspond to variables at the end of my operation, and I'll measure some assignment, and then I can test whether that assignment solves my problem. So I'll get 0, 1, 0, whatever, and I can check whether or not this solves my sat problem very efficiently. But yes, it starts here. They're going to start off in equal superposition, and then I'm going to build this circuit corresponding to my sat problem, and I'm going to call it USAT. This is only applied once, but this is a unitary matrix that I can exponentiate. I can keep applying it, and if I apply it enough, I can keep reducing the probability in the states that don't satisfy my problem. And I believe, and people that I've talked to believe, that in the limit of infinite iterations, I will have a 100% chance of satisfying my problem, which is, yes?
What is the yellow box again?
So this is what I'm calling the gates we build corresponding to the sat problem, just one iteration of it.
Oh, sorry, like the small box that does the ancilla operation.
This one?
Yes.
This is just a projective measurement. I set it back to zero. So I could measure it and then put it back in the zero basis, a pure state. I could equivalently like swap it with another one, or as long as I just get this qubit that's important for the subsequent calculations back to the zero state, that's all that matters. So this is a destructive process, but I could make it reversible if I wanted to.
It's a reset gate, right?
A reset gate. Sets it back to the zero state. Just like it started off here in the zero state, I reset it back to the zero state because I'm done with this computation.
I mean, like, so you do like a projective measurement, and then with some probability you get a one or a zero.
Yep, and then I can just maneuver it back into the zero state.
Not conditioned on what state?
No, it doesn't matter. I can measure anything and it won't affect anything.
So the way I understand the diagram now is the left half implements the first bracket, the second
yes.
half implements the second bracket.
Yes.
And kind of you put them together because you want
yes.
the whole thing to be
yes.
satisfied. Why are you changing what qubit implements C and D?
So the C and the D, this is a bad convention of naming variables by my part. These are meaningless. This is just you could think of it as 1, 2, and 3. Really, this is D. This line corresponding to the variable D is a qubit. This is C, B, and A. So these will never change. These are corresponding directly to the variables. These are just labels. So these just tell you which ones I'm acting on. It's an unfortunate naming convention.
Anything to
nothing. Yeah, nothing. Yeah, my bad. Yes?
Could you explain to me how the OR, so this thing is like something or something. Could you explain to me how the OR is working in the circuit?
So really, all I'm doing is I'm basically ignoring these ORs because all I'm interested in are the possible combinations that make this true, because that makes my regular SAT false. So I'm individually acting on each of these clauses, and at the end, I will have acted on all of the states that don't satisfy my problem by the end of performing one of these operations corresponding to every clause. Because you can think of if a state doesn't get hit by every single one of these operations, then it must satisfy my problem, because it doesn't satisfy the not of all of the other clauses, you know? So what I'm going to be left with is a bunch of states that solve my problem that have not been touched by any of these operations. Yes?
And could you comment again on the double C-naught, like after you apply your R3, the RC3X thing, you're reintroducing the not?
Yes, so this is just to select the part of the wave function that is zero here, and is one here and one here. And then I want to undo that computation so I can keep track of what it's set to for subsequent ones. So you can imagine if like this knot was on the A as well, I could just do it once here and then I wouldn't have to switch it back. I could just do it again. But this is just to keep it clear of what variables are knotted, whether I'm interested in the zero or one part. It's just to keep track. And this just reverses whatever is done here, but it still selects the part of the wave function corresponding to 0, 1, 1. Okay. So now we're going to do a bit of a live demonstration. Do you know what the...
26.
Okay. So, you see this? Okay, here we have this exact SAT that I built. So now we're just going to walk through and see what the probabilities do when I perform these sorts of operations. So we're going to get to the state vector. Okay. So before I applied these gates, these were all in equal superposition. What I've done is I've selected the part of the wave function where it's 0, 1, 1. That's the first three qubits, 0, 1, 1. And then the fourth qubit doesn't matter. It'll select both of them because it's not in the actual computation. So this will be 0, 1, 1, 1. And it takes them and it moves them over here to where the last qubit is flipped from 0 to 1. And now I'm going to perform a controlled Hadamard on the first qubit. So I'm going to add a control. I'm going to go based on Q4. And what this does, as you can see, is it splits the probability that was over here in half. It's for both states, splits it in half. And then I'm going to do the same for the next variable. And we're going to see what this does with it. Now, it splits those in half again. Now I have it split over four once. And then once I do it for the final qubit, we are left with that part of the wave function that used to be here and used to be here is now equally distributed over all of the states, but where the last qubit is one. So now, if I were to trace out that last qubit, if I only care about the variables, this will just get directly added to all of these. These are the amplitudes. So I'll be left with a smaller probability in the states that don't satisfy my problem, and I'll be left with a slightly higher probability in all the states that do not satisfy that clause. Yes?
The phase here, does that not matter?
I don't know how it matters, if I'm being honest. Okay. In my limited amount of playing with this, I haven't seen how it does.
Okay.
I would love to talk about it, but I don't fully understand what it means yet. So then I can do the rest of the operations. It does the exact same thing for the other ones. This looks a little wonky, but it's the same thing, I promise. And we're going to look at the probability distribution. So we can see the states that don't satisfy my problem have all been reduced, and the rest are slightly higher than how they started. And I can take, I can take these gates, and I can apply them again, and it does the exact same thing. It takes the states that don't satisfy my problem and reduces them even further. And I can keep applying this an infinite number of times, and I will have a 100% probability of measuring at the end an assignment that satisfies my problem. This is a claim. I haven't proven it, but it seems straightforward to prove. And I
can do that.
That'll be the first step in my yes, I
say.
And why did you change the circuit now?
So all I did, like I was just showing you how it acts on the first one. But it does the exact same thing here, but on different states.
Let's say like the number of CNOTs was different, right?
They were in different places. They were up here, but it's the exact same thing. I could move them down. It was a slightly different problem. But yeah, I can build this for any SAT that you give me, and I can show you that it will.
Since it was.
Yes. I was just playing around with it before because I wanted to see. Because right now these have no overlap. This all the states that satisfy this one will not satisfy this one. But if I move these two up, then they will share a single state. So there will be three states that don't satisfy my SAT problem, and that's what I was looking at before I brought the presentation. I just didn't move it back. But really, it's analogous for any possible combinations, anything. I can build any SAT corresponding, I can build a corresponding circuit to any SAT. So this is just sort of an example of how it looks. I've constructed a problem that has two solutions. It has four variables, so there's 16 combinations, and it has two solutions. This is after one iteration of my algorithm. You can see it started at, 0.125 probability in all states, and now it's left at 0.144 in both states, and a reduced probability in all the unsatisfiable ones. Now, there's seven clauses in this problem, so if I iterate it seven times, I'm left with over an 80% chance of measuring a solution to my problem. Very quickly decreases the probability in all the unsatisfiable states and makes it very likely that I'll measure a solution to my problem. But does this scale? This is a very small constructed problem, arbitrary you could say, but does it scale? Well, I don't know. But I've constructed problems that I think would be hard for this algorithm to do, but I don't know that. What I've done is I've built problems that have only one solution. They have a single solution, and they also have what I believe to be the minimum number of clauses. So when I showed you how to build the unitary corresponding to the problem, you might expect that the more clauses I have, the more chances I have to reduce probability in unsatisfiable states. So I wanted to minimize that. And I also minimize the number of solutions because the less solutions you have, the harder it should be to solve. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply this unitary C times, the number of clauses in the problem, which scales linearly as the size of the input. And we're going to see how it scales as it increases the size of the problem. So if I add more variables and they still only have one solution, and they have this many clauses, let's see how it scales as I increase the size of the problem. I get this terrible graph with no axes or anything, but what it is This is the probability. It's okay. I'm going to explain it to you. They don't need axes. Okay. This is the probability of measuring the single solution to my SAT problem after I apply that unitary c times. And this is the number of variables, number of qubits in my problem. So it gets a little hairy after 14. It becomes a very long computation because I'm dealing with 16,000 by 16,000 matrices or whatever. And it's hard for computers. But you can see, this is pretty linear. Squint your eyes a bit, and this looks pretty, that looks pretty straight, you know? But this is not a proof. This means nothing about how it scales in the large term. But it's fun to look at, and it gives me hope that maybe, you know, who knows? So this is just, it's a very arbitrary, constructed problem that I invented. No one's interested in solving these kinds of SATs, but it's meant to illustrate how it grows with the size of the input. Yes?
When does the probability peak for, 2 qubits or something?
3 qubits. I don't know. But it seems to be, it's very simple for it to just solve 3-qubit problems. I can do it with different types of problems. It will always have the most, seemingly the most, at 3 qubits, and then it'll slightly decrease, and then it'll be pretty much linear after that. Yes?
Say I have a 3-set that has, 2 solutions.
Yep.
The next slide or
nope.
Something. But if they have 2 solutions which are disjoint,
mm-hmm.
Say one of the solutions is A, B, C are all 1,
mm-hmm.
and everything else is 0, and the other one is D, E, F are all 1, and everything
mm-hmm.
else is 0.
Mm-hmm.
If you run this a bunch of times, does it say, all of them going to be equally probable to measure?
No. So the probability distribution actually is very difficult to calculate for me. I need to run simulations to tell me what the output will be, and I don't know a way of proving it, how it should look in general for problems. It even matters the order of operations that you do. If I do different clauses in different orders, the probability distribution will slightly change, which I don't fully understand, but I think it's because when I showed you the probability splitting, it splitted locally. So it took this probability from this unsatisfiable state and moved it directly to its neighbor, and then that did that as well. So you could imagine if I select a state that has already very low probability, the neighbors of that state will gain a very low, low probability after that. But the ones that have a larger probability, its neighbors will gain more probability. So the order that I apply the clauses also matters to the final distribution, but it doesn't matter for the satisfiable states because they never get touched in the entire process. All that's happening is probability is getting jumbled around and some of it lands in the satisfiable states. And the ones that are unsatisfiable always get it removed at least once per unitary operation corresponding to the SAT.
What I mean is just that, in a simpler example, say I have two qubits,
mm-hmm.
and my SAT has 2 solutions. One of them is A is true. One of them is that B is true. Will it end up telling me that I should pick both A and B?
No. All I ever measure is a state corresponding to a real truth assignment of the problem. So I measure a single one of those states. So I will only ever measure them correlated together. So I'll only ever measure 0, 1 or 1, 0.
Mm-hmm.
I will never measure 1, 1 because it's more likely for each one to be one individually. It will always be a correct combination corresponding to something that I will try with my actual SAT algorithm.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, they are correlated heavily, yes.
Do you know how hard it is to classically find the non-solution to a given set, 3-set problem?
It's very easy. I just...
Especially the same thing. No?
Yes, but what you can't do classically is find a solution from finding the unsat. So I can enumerate all the problems or all of the combinations, or you give me a combination that I'm going to try, and I can tell you if it's unsatisfiable or satisfiable or not. That's very easy to do. It's an O of N operation. But finding the actual solution is very difficult to do classically. This seems like I'm just selecting the states that don't satisfy it and doing an operation on them, which I could do classically, but I'm going to argue that something fundamentally different is going on because it preserves information as you move through the circuit. Where if I were just doing a classical random walk or something, it only depends on my current position. That's all that matters.
Yeah, if I had to pick paraphrase kind of what I took away from how your thing works is you find one solution that doesn't work, and mm-hmm. then you have a nice way of dispersing into the rest of the solution space from there,
mm-hmm.
kind of like blackening out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just curious if, I mean, I'm sure you're just looking at it, but I mean, if you have a lot, how many variables do people typically look at when they have a SAT problem that is of actual interest?
Ooh, okay. So RSA, what underlines all of our encryption for security and on the internet and everything, can be reduced to factoring, which if you reduce that to SAT, has like a couple thousand variables, I think. Problems with a few thousand variables, very difficult to solve classically. But these ones I could solve instantaneously on a classical computer.
Because it seems like the number of Hadamard gates you need scales in the same way as your variables.
Yes. In the number of clauses, really. So the number of clauses will dictate how many of the operations I perform for a given.
Number of clauses times the number of
variables in a clause. In this case, it'll always be three because we're working with three SAT, but it could generalize to any number of SAT.
I have a similar question. I'm trying to understand the difference between, if you were to do this classically,
mm-hmm.
you'd have a big list of all the states that you can have.
Yes.
And then you would.
Let me just remind you, for 300 variables, I would need more states than there are particles in the universe. It's not possible to enumerate them all for 300 qubits, for 300 variables. So for 1,000 or 2,000 variables, it becomes fundamentally uncomputable.
I guess the question is, why can you do this on a quantum computer? Like, what's the...
Because the amount of information encoded in n qubits is exponential. The same number of possible combinations I could form out of n regular bits. But when I deal with classical computers, there's always a definite state that it's in. But in this, it can be some superposition of all the states. And I can perform computations as though I'm acting on every single state at once.
So
that's pretty fun.
Classically, you'd have to keep track of, like, to the n,
yes.
to the n
yes.
list, like, long.
Yes, yes.
For your algorithm, just the
all. Yes, exactly. So I would need 2 to the n classical bits to do the same thing classically, but in this case, I need n qubits, which is much less.
Seems like a strategy you could probably apply to many problems.
Oh, yeah.
Nice way of making a tree.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, how different is your like circuit from like Grover search algorithm? Because it's very similar.
It rhymes almost, you know, but Grover search algorithm has been shown to only have a square root or quadratic speedup.
Yeah.
So if a problem would take O of the n steps, I could do it in O of the n over 2 steps. I'm hoping that mine performs better than that. It's very possible that it scales the same, but I do think it acts fundamentally differently. You're applying the same operation to all the states in Grover search algorithm. You're just giving a phase to the ones that are in your solution state, and then you're giving the opposite phase to the other ones, and then you're flipping them all at once. But this acts only on the parts of the wave function that don't satisfy my problem. So it's not acting on the whole wave function at once. So I think there's fundamentally a different, I'll need to do a different analysis on this algorithm if I want to prove something about its complexity. Everyone that I've talked to so far agrees that it's not like any other algorithm, and that we're going to need to invent new methods of analyzing algorithms, which, even if this turns out to be exponential or something, we will still have, if we can succeed in proving something about it, we'll have proved something about a whole class of quantum algorithms that have not even been discovered yet. So that'd be very cool. So I want it to be polynomial, but it doesn't have to be interesting. Yes.
Are you allowed to have no satisfying solution?
Yes, and what that would mean is if I can prove the complexity of the algorithm, then I should perform the same number of operations corresponding to the size of the problem. And at the end, I just test a bunch of the ones that it gives me. And if none of them are satisfiable, then I have a very high likelihood of the problem not being satisfiable.
What does it give you?
It's a random noise.
Yeah. Only random?
No, I don't know. But it won't have a single peak. Because what it means is that all of the states are unsatisfiable. And they will all be hit by our algorithm at some point. They will all have the probability reduced. And the probability will move to other states. So it'll be some random arbitrary distribution. You'll measure basically noise. So it won't settle to some fixed point. It will bounce around indefinitely.
And then with large operations, shouldn't you expect it to reduce to a uniform distribution because every non-solution would be
yes. in the limit of infinite iterations, it should reach a fixed point where the only probability is in the satisfiable states. So this would be, if I can prove the algorithm is complete, that would mean that. It would mean in the limit of infinite iterations, I will have a 100% chance on a perfect quantum computer with no noise of measuring a solution to my problem. Yes?
But then there's no satisfying solutions. It gives you a non-uniform random output.
Mm-hmm.
Does that look like another problem that has a solution?
That I don't know. All I care about is the problem that I'm given and I'm trying to solve, and then I measure the qubits. They will give me some assignment. I will test that assignment to my problem. If it solves it, great, I've solved my problem. If it doesn't, and it keeps not solving my problem, then after a certain number of iterations, I can say with a lot of confidence that there might be no solution to my problem. And exactly how confident I will be will depend on the complexity of the algorithm and how well it scales and stuff. But if there's some polynomial number of times I need to apply this unitary, then I can say with a lot of certainty, like statistical certainty, the more I do it, the more likely it is that there's just no solution to my problem. But all it takes is to solve it once to say that there is a solution. And that's what this algorithm will do if there is one. Yes.
Say like the sort of like loophole to figuring out how to solve like NP complete problems in a nicer way here. Would that lie in its probabilistic nature, or just the fact that there's so much information you can encode in relatively fewer qubits?
Yes, I think it's the latter, because I can build a classical probabilistic algorithm that seems to do the similar thing. Like you could imagine I start out in some random state. I'll check if the state satisfies the clause that corresponds to an unsat. And if it does, then I'll randomly flip those three qubits and move to the next clause. And it looks almost like that's what the quantum algorithm is doing. But I believe in the preliminary tests that I've done, it performs much differently. I think dealing with small problems, I might be able to prove that fundamentally it acts differently. Like there will be a higher probability of measuring a satisfiable assignment after n steps with the quantum algorithm versus the classical random walk. That I haven't done yet. I will keep you updated. If you find me in the hall, track me down. I'll tell you everything I know. Yes. So yeah. Yes.
Follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Even a classical probability distribution, mm-hmm. you could say encodes a huge amount of information, like an exponential amount. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So maybe we say sample a random string, flip a clause, mm-hmm. according to whether it satisfies or not.
Yes.
So how would you say your algorithm is different? I mean, I would disagree that you claim that because it encodes a huge amount of information that
yes. Yes.
for speed up, but that's the fundamental difference between yes. classical and quantum computing.
Yes. Yes.
In this particular context, not the general answer. In this particular algorithm, what would you say is different that gives you some hope that
yes.
this can do something better?
I will put on my speculation hat, because of course I'm not sure, but I think that it is because it preserves information about its past history as I continue the process. The state that gets acted on after the second iteration is different than after the first iteration, is different after the third iteration. But if I consider like a random walk, all that matters is my current state. I perform the same operation no matter what my history was. I could have gone right to the solution and back to the beginning, and all that matters is my current state. But in the quantum case, the distribution changes after every single operation and acts on the wave function as a whole. So, like...
I would disagree, right? I mean, in a random walk, you can think of the full random walk as a stochastic map.
Yes.
From distribution over bit strings to distribution mm-hmm. over bit strings.
Yes.
And that picture...
Yes.
That's not a whole lot different.
Yes.
In a quantum state with a unitary matrix. So, I mean, mm-hmm. this is honestly, I would maybe emphasize a little less on that part of the...
Yes.
Part of the,
for sure. Yes, yeah. No, this is pure speculation. I have no idea, and I hope to prove it. We'll see.
And the other question, so, you say that this is a unitary process.
Yes.
But then you're claiming that there's a fixed point that you reach after some number of steps.
Mm-hmm.
A general unitary operation won't have a stable fixed point that you reach.
The fixed point will be at infinite operations. So we will never, in practice...
If you add a unitary even infinite times, we'll just do some rotation in the quantum state space.
Mm.
So I would say like this indicates that what you're doing is not quite unitary. Like measurement and not it.
Ah.
Which probably makes it non-unitary. Otherwise you don't
Well I don't see how it would, like, I could make it completely reversible. Well, I mean, so the non-unitary part, I think, comes from the measurement at the end, because if I could just do it without measurement and not reset the bits after each one, and I could completely uncompute it back to the zero state that we started in, that's fine. But when I perform a measurement midway through the calculation, that destroys the unitarity of the system. So I do yes, break unitary. Yes.
Question, but then we should.
Yes. Yes. For sure.
You can ask the question.
Yeah.
You can ask the question after that. You should probably finish talk.
Yeah. So sorry. I think maybe it breaks unitarity in that sense, because if you're going to get to a fixed point and go to infinity and keep it unitary, so you need a new qubit every time.
Yes.
You need like infinite qubits.
Yes. This is also true. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think that's why.
Okay.
With our model.
Okay. Very interesting. I like it. All right. So this is pretty much the last slide, I think. Next steps, what I hope to do is prove the correctness. This seems very reasonable. I should be able to do this. There's some methods of proving correctness of sorts of algorithms like this, maybe. So I'm going to try to repeat that for this algorithm, show that in the limit of infinite iterations, it solves every problem. That would be step number one. Pretty cool. Next, I'm going to see how it performs in small instances against classical algorithms. Maybe I'll see if I can prove that it performs better than the best classical algorithms probabilistically, and that would be a good sign that maybe it's doing something fundamentally different than the classical counterpart. That would be another great step. And then finally, this is the big one, I'm going to try to prove how many iterations are necessary to give me some constant probability of measuring a solution for any sized problem. This is going to be very difficult. We don't even know if it's possible. But it seems in principle possible. And if we can prove something about this algorithm, we will have proven something about a whole class of algorithms like this one that have not had any proofs about them yet. So even if it turns out to be exponential, even if it's not that cool, we'll still have shown a new method of proving the complexity of certain types of quantum algorithms, which is neat enough. But that is very open-ended, and I don't know if it's even possible, so I'll tell you in a couple months whether I've done that. But this is where I'll end it off, and I'll say thank you to my friend Craig. He's in the Zoom meeting, hopefully. Craig, are you here?
Yep.
Oh, Craig! Okay, this is Craig. He's been a huge help over the years. He gave a great insight to the algorithm. He made it so that I was doing controlled Hadamards and not just rotations. I was doing different things that scaled similarly, but he really made it what it is today. And I've spent literally months talking his ear off in real time. So thank you, Craig. He's a big collaborator. Also, David Gossett and Anirban. This is going to be a fun PSI project, hopefully. We'll see how it goes. Thanks for taking me on. This will be lots of fun, and thank y'all for listening. We'll